This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by a doctor and an author who's got two new books out in the last 12 months. Actually, great reading about physician burnout and how not to burn out and how to thrive. Dr. Gary Simmons is located now living in North Carolina, has been with the Carilion System. Gary, take a moment and introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do.
Well, I am Gary Simmons. I, for 16 years, was the chief of neurosurgery, program director of the residency training program at Carilion Clinic and Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine in Roanoke, Virginia, and I actually just retired a few months ago.
Well, congratulations. And how is retirement going? Do you miss practice? Do you miss teaching? How is retirement evolving?
So far, so good. There aren't enough hours in the day, so that's probably a good sign. I'm actually working on a couple of novels, but I'm staying connected with the medical school, the residency training program, and actually the Virginia Tech School of Neuroscience, where I'm acting as a as an advisor for students interested in health-related careers. And I'm also doing some of that down here in North Carolina with a couple of local colleges.
That's fantastic. And tell us about, I had a chance to browse through one of your books this morning. Tell us about the most recent book that you authored and what led you to author it.
Okay, and actually, to be able to do that, I'll tell you briefly about the original book. Originally, Wayne Sotiel, a clinical psychologist and basically a world expert on physician burnout and wellness, he and I teamed up to write a book on burnout and resilience building in neurosurgeons, and that was entitled Building Resilience in Neurosurgical Residents. And it got a very positive response, but people kept saying to us, you do realize that other physicians than neurosurgeons burn out. Why were you so narrow in your focus? And so we put together and wrote the second book called The Thriving Physician, Oriented to All Physicians. And then people started coming to us and saying, other people in healthcare burn out. Why did you narrow your focus only on physicians? So put together Thriving in Healthcare, and that's oriented to, frankly, everybody who's involved in healthcare, in the delivery of healthcare. So that's how it came about.
And just a little bit about, the book is very practical in nature. It's thoughtful and practical. A little bit about some of the ideas on avoiding burnout and staying fresh, staying sharp. What are some of the thoughts on, you know, how you do that?
Well, there's a lot of ideas thrown out in the book, but there is some basic fundamental principles. One of the things that's important for us to make clear is that the healthcare environment, the work environment, is pretty challenging for everybody. And there are many things on the institutional level that could probably be done to improve the situation for all involved. But we tried to steer away from that in the books and just touch on it lightly, because to be frank, we're not holding our breath that all of a sudden the healthcare workplace is going to be a Shangri-La. So what we wanted to do was arm the individual practitioners and providers with some practical and very pragmatic and simple and straightforward concepts and activities and exercises that could be done to be able to help themselves and not to have to depend on, you know, these big, mighty healthcare institutions steering into better waters, because it takes a while to change the course and get there. And in the meantime, everybody's feeling stress and everybody's feeling time compressed and feeling the tragedies that go on around them and all the various stressors that we talk about in the book. So a few of the main points that we would drive home, and probably one of the biggest central issues, is that most people in healthcare become very focused on the well-being of others. That's what healthcare is all about, that you do everything you can to try to help people who are sick or people who are injured. And they do it to the point of the extreme where they forget to take care of themselves. And one of the central issues that we push is that people need to practice what we would call self-compassion and self-care. And that is grant themselves without guilt the ability to look at themselves and say, how am I faring? How am I doing in this current situation right now? What do I need to be able to keep going? And we're very poor at that. Everybody in medicine is just very poor in it. But if it can be done, then one can actually tend to areas in their world that are potentially lagging. Beyond that, we have a whole slew of suggestions, but a couple of the big ones and a couple of the very effective ones would be as follows. One is that in healthcare, you're faced with a lot of bad stuff. It can be disease, it can be death, it can be illness, it can be bad outcomes, it can be complications, it can be time constraints, it can be problems with employees, it can be problems with equipment that's not working, that sort of thing. And we're surrounded by things that aren't going well. And we tend to get fixated and focused on it because it's our job to make them go better. What we miss and what we forget that's going on at the same time is that there are a million amazing things going on around us. We live in a time of true miracles through medicine. We live in a time where we're actually able to cure a lot of diseases and help the ones that we can't cure. There's new discoveries going on all the time, new technologies. So there's tremendous wonder, tremendous fascination, tremendous positive outcomes going on all the time, but we tend to lose track on that. So one of the central themes is to be able to collect uplifts, is to be able to recognize the good stuff that's going on around us, even to the point of maybe even documenting it, noting it, writing it down, or putting it into a phone and reflecting on it at some point when there's a little bit of quiet time, at all the amazing and positive things that are happening around us amongst all the other stressors. And then the counter to that is, because there are stressors going on all the time and the stressors aren't going to go away, we have to learn how to deal with it. And what we tend to do is pack it inside and allow it to kind of jam up like a log jam. And one of the things we think is critical is to be able to debrief, to talk about various stressors with people that we trust. And that means trusted colleagues or friends or family members, to be able to just release some of the negative energy, some of the negative effects of the day or the week, with people who can lend an ear and understand. Now, when we don't advocate getting all super focused on the minutia and having it turn into a gripe session, but rather to be able to discuss what's gone on and how we've reacted to it, how it's impacted our thoughts, our feelings, the way we're dealing with other people, and looking with other people on how we might react better and feel better for it. And it turns out just being able to put this stuff onto a table helps dissipate it. So those are a couple of examples. And of course, we go through quite a bit in the books.
Well, no, thank you very much. What's your biggest priority this year? When you look at this year, you're post into retirement now, but obviously you're keeping yourself very, very active, very busy. What do you look at as your biggest priority this year? How do you reset purpose once you've retired?
Well, I guess I'm just discovering that right away. And my reasons for retirement were multifactorial, to be honest. Which is very personal, actually, but some of it was basically neglecting my wife of 39 years and throwing everything I had into neurosurgery. And one of the last things on earth I wanted to do, and I had envisioned staying in neurosurgery, in active clinical neurosurgery, quite a few years more, but I began worrying about being one of those guys who drops the scalpel and falls into a wheelchair, and then all of a sudden just becoming a burden to my wife and having her have to be my nurse after so many years of being a single mom, if you will. So one of my biggest goals is to actually give myself and my time to my lovely wife, which is something I'm working at. And everybody asks her whether she'll be able to tolerate it or not, and we'll see about that. But in addition, of course, we're trying to get the word out. Wayne and I feel very passionately about the wellness and the resilience building, and we really want to get the word out as far as we can, and we thank entities such as yours, because that will very much help us do it. We think it is a critical problem. There's almost a hysteria around it right now. We want to kind of soften the hysteria, dampen any work ambivalence that may be growing from it, but again, arm people with practical ways to go through their work and their lives and get as much value and balance out of that as possible.
Advice for leaders, and again, the healthcare ecosystem. In most ecosystems today, anybody who's had anything for 20, 30, 40 years ends up with some level of burnout. And certainly in the health industry, it can be very acute. What advice do you have for leaders? I mean, we all recognize there's only so much leaders can do, because they also work in a vacuum, too, of trying to keep the whole system working and everything going. But what can they do to help improve the situation for providers, for employees, for staff, for everybody?
Well, we list a number of things that that leaders potentially can do for their systems. And as we talked about it, it's a bit of, you know, it's like trying to turn around the Queen Mary sometimes. So it's not like they can wave a wand and do some change everything instantly. But a great example you and I discussed before we started this. Nancy Agee, who's the CEO of our system, and she's a great example, and that is, she is open to ideas. She is open to ways to make things better for everybody in the system. So when I came to her many years ago and said, hey, you know, I know you guys have Wayne Sotiel coming and working on leadership with the system, but I want him to come spend time with me and get a real introduction to what we think is some of the most intense practice of medicine and some of the more aberrant and maladaptive responses to it, and that is neurosurgery. She was very open and allowed us to take quite a bit of the time that he was in the system for, because he was a consultant to the system a month and made monthly visits. But I was allowed to take several of his hours away and have him spend it with our entire team and work on things and research things in the resilience realm. And that to me shows just a tremendous dedication on Nancy's part to improving the system. And therefore, you know, the concept of being open and willing to look at ways to work on this, to recognize that it's a problem, to recognize that there's probably no single answer and no single epiphany that everybody's going to have, but rather to try different methods and methodologies. We certainly believe in getting the leaders down amongst the people in the trenches and vice versa, because as you pointed out, the leaders have a tough job. You know, the people in the trenches, they have a tough job. They have to care for the patients and the family members and that sort of thing. But I think in the trenches, we fail to realize all the rules and regulations and federal impositions and state mandates and all that that's being thrown at a system at any one time. And the administration is the interface for that. On the other hand, the guys in the trenches are doing the real work of health, of the providing the care. And sometimes the administrations get disconnected from that. And I think the more the two meet and the more the two understand the pressures on both ends, the more it will help alleviate a lot of the stress and misunderstanding. So there's a couple
I think
of
you
thoughts.
Yeah, no, you said some great, great things, Gary. I mean, first of all, Dr. Simmons, you talk about this quality of an administrative leader or somebody that's overseeing a system, and you start with just having an open mind and being willing to have the dialogue, not being so authoritative and dictatorial that you're not willing to even think and listen and hear. And I think you credit Nancy Agee well, and she grew up in the trenches, grew up in the system, of being willing to at least start the conversation by listening and then allowing it to be explored and delved into and so forth. And I think that is itself great advice. The other thing you said, and I thought it was fascinating, is that the leadership needs to understand, and when I say that, I mean administrative leadership needs to know what's going on the clinical side, actually in the trenches of work. But you also said the opposite, that the people that are physicians and staff and nurses and allied health care practitioners also have to understand what leadership is dealing with. And I think the point is often understated, and it's well stated by yourself. People that are physicians and that grew up sort of on the physician side of the equation started with sort of a kind of negative bias towards administrative leadership. And not until the physicians sort of step into those shoes and see what leadership does, do they realize how difficult a job it is running large health systems or small health systems or provider organizations in today's world. And I think that mutual respect, that mutual understanding is so important and so enlightening. And just understanding helps take some of the tension out of the air and helps to make people a little bit more resilient, which is as important as it gets when trying to fight burnout. Dr. Simmons, one more question. I've got so many I'd like to ask you, but I won't keep you for that long, I promise. How do you now, as you get going in this next phase of life, keep yourself motivated and excited day to day? I mean, you don't have the call and structure of doing surgery X days a week, running into the hospital all the time. How do you now find the energy, you know, and to keep yourself motivated, but in a different way, at a different pace? How do you sort of find that day to day?
Well, I guess you know, you remain curious, you remain connected, you look for other routes for your interest. For me, it's pretty easy, to be frank. I have a whole number of different interests. A lot of it, I still want to write. I'm writing novels right now. I have musical instruments, so I play the guitar and banjo and want to learn the fiddle and, believe it or not, the bagpipes. So We tried to move to a place without a lot of neighbors. But in all seriousness, one of the things is that neurosurgery and work is a fatiguing, a physically fatiguing situation. And you don't really even realize it until you're out of it. The amount of call, the lost sleep, the amount of running around, the time you're on your feet for many, many hours operating, even just working under a microscope for several hours, an operating microscope for several hours, I always found was quite exhausting. And all of a sudden now I have all this energy. I'm not fatigued all the time. And so the energy is just automatically there. It's more than anything, it's just channeling it into various interests. And again, I think, you know, having the resilience and the wellness issue that we really want to get out there gives me kind of a sacred charge. And then my other sacred charge, as I said, is trying to actually be a husband for a while. It seems pretty easy thus far, but it's only a few months, so you may have to check again with me later.
No, that's fantastic. I give you great credit. Most people are not able to hang it up until they are forced to, and that willingness to do so and see there is more to it than this. I don't want to be one of these people that falls over with my scalpel in his hand. It is really an impressive, impressive thing to be able to do and make that choice. So congratulations on that. The other thing I'll ask you about this, and whether you worry about this, you had said that it was good with you practicing all these different musical instruments that you don't have that many neighbors. Do you ever have great concern that as you practice more and more, that the neighborhood will grow and be around the house listening to you, and that you'll end up inadvertently creating a new community of huge critical mass around your house?
I doubt with the bagpipes. I don't see that one occurring. I will note too, I was being a little jovial. We actually live very close to a bunch of neighbors, so I don't know what kind of soundproofing I'm going to have to do. But it does bring one of the other critical factors of building resilience, and I'm going to throw this one out at you that I should mention. And that is a phenomenon that I think is very true, and that is when we're in medicine, when we're practicing in medicine, it is very common to slowly or rapidly constrict your circle of close or intimate relations so that you begin to lose track and contact with friends, even your family. And everybody we've ever polled on this in medicine completely concurs. You say, you know, do you have more friends or less friends than 5 years ago? And it's always less. Do you speak with your family more or visit with your family more or less? And it's always less. And we think this is another torpedo into resilience. We think it's critical that throughout this, that people actually make the effort, that they put the effort in to maintain and even grow their relationships around them, to have a large infrastructure of friends and family. And hopefully we do that in retirement as well, but I think it's critical during a professional career.
Well, fantastic. I think you're absolutely right. And Dr. Simmons, it's been an incredible pleasure to speak to you today. Much deeper and longer conversation. I'm so glad that you were introduced to us, because it was just a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you so much.
Well, I thank you so very much.